Greetings once again to the crew of the Dian Navigation Experiment, to friends and ex-friends, friends to come, students and allies of past, present, and future scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen, including enemies or would-be enemies. This is John Lash, your navigator, recording on the early hours of Sunday, the 12th of January, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 103, Pristine and Copacetic. To start this briefing, let me make reference to some language that I just used. This is the first time, you might note, that I have used the term enemies in the greeting of the, in the salutation of my briefings. I like that word, salutation. You know, salutation is related to the root of the word salute, which is related to salubrity, and salut, which means health in French. So a salutation is a call to health and salubrity, and a greeting and an invocation of sanity. In any case, what was I saying? Oh yeah, I used the words enemies and would-be enemies. That is the only time these words will ever occur in a salutation. I'd like to make it absolutely clear about my view on enemies. First of all, I consider that there would be in my life two kinds of enemies, that is, personal and non-personal. The personal enemies would have something against me personally and perhaps be out to harm me or my way of life. And the non-personal enemies would, say, include people who are against Planetary Tantra and who think that I'm a cult leader and that Planetary Tantra is, I don't know, a disguised form of Satanism or some other kind of dementia, or that my teachings are erroneous and misleading and harmful. I wouldn't even call those people enemies. I would call them opponents of the Sophianic message in the way that I deliver it. So let's leave those aside, and let's just look for a moment at the issue of personal enemies. Well, I don't have any personal enemies. That is to say, there is no one in my personal realm of acquaintance who is my enemy. And to this day, there is no one in my personal realm of acquaintance who has declared themselves to be an enemy to me. This is a simple fact. Now, when I say my personal realm of acquaintance, let me be perfectly clear about this as well. By the way, I'm going into this not to drag you into another harangue or another long excursion and digression into personal material that is inappropriate to the GNE. No, not at all. I'm doing it so that I can introduce to you some existential issues that bear profoundly upon the question of Gaian ethics and ethics within the tribe and the Kalika war party. So, bear with me when I talk in the future about anything personal, when I introduce any personal material, and of course I won't name names, but when I describe issues and encounters, conflicts and situations directly from my personal life, understand that I am doing so by way of illustration. So, when I say my circles of personal acquaintance, I refer to people who have actually met me. Now, as you know, those of you in the GNE crew, and those many, many, countless numbers of you who've read Not in His Image, and who've read the Metahistory site, or encountered me from some other angle, have not met me personally, and probably never will. Well, there are a few people who've met me personally. Not many, but there are some. People come and go. And over the last, say, 5 years since I got to Terma, there have been, I'd say, a couple of dozen people coming in and out of my life who've met me personally, in some cases only for a day, for an encounter for an afternoon, in some cases for a few days at a time, and in some cases for longer periods. So there are some people who encounter the navigator in person. And among those people, as far as I know, none of them have declared themselves to me to be my enemies. Nor do I regard any of them as my enemies. So I can proudly and happily tell you that in regard to my personal encounters, flesh and blood in this world, I don't have any enemies. I don't seek to have enemies. Goddess knows. It ought to be fairly obvious by now that I've got enough on my hands to tackle the problem of interspecies predators and how to use contra-violence and perhaps Gaian tantric magic against the predators and psychopaths running roughshod over this planet. I've got enough on my hands that I don't need the exercise of personal enemies. I think I can safely say that by using this language, quote, personal enemies, unquote, I'm not being entirely personal. After all, don't any of you out there listening to me have some problem with personal enemies in your life? Have you not had such problems? We all have had those problems, I suppose. But you know, personal conflict with others does not necessarily lead to them being enemies. So how do I define the term enemy? Let's be specific in the syntax. In my case, a personal enemy in my life would be somebody, A, who has met me personally, in the flesh, in person, and B, who declares to me that they are an enemy who intends to do me harm. Period. So, those are the two requirements. Those are the two criteria. So far, of those who have met me personally over the last few years, no one has come forth in writing or words to say to me directly, I declare myself as your enemy, and perhaps to add, acting as your enemy, I intend to do such and such and so by way of harming you. Well, this is important to understand. What is important to understand? It's important to understand the factor of self-declaration. Does that remind you of something? Remember a while ago I asked the question, or I said, try this as an exercise in social communication. When you're out somewhere, at a bar or at someone's house for dinner, or taking a stroll with an acquaintance or friend, ask them the question, who are the enemies of humanity? And see what ensues. And then after they've responded, ask them the second question, well, who are the self-declared enemies of humanity? Well, that certainly narrows down the suspects, doesn't it? And likewise, if I say, who are the self-declared enemies of John Lash? Well, that certainly narrows down the suspects, doesn't it? Now, there may be people out there who know me, that is to say, who've met me in person, or who have not met me in person but have had contact with me through the internet, through Skype or email, who have taken the position of being my enemies. This is possible, and this could be possible for any of you as well. Whether or not you have a professional role and profile as a teacher, and by the way, I'm not a famous author and I don't have a huge reputation and I'm not rich on my writings and I charge nothing for my teaching of planetary tantra, you know that. But regardless of whether I would be such a famous person or a moderately well-known person. I'm just like you. I have contacts on the internet. I have emails with people. I exchange emails with people, both that I've met personally and that I haven't. And if it were to occur that someone among those people, someone among those contacts, decided to be my enemy, how would I know unless they declared it to me? Now, before I go any further, because I've been talking for 10 minutes, I must insert this assertion. This briefing is not going to be entirely dedicated to this subject. This briefing is dedicated to some current and highly relevant intel regarding planetary events and the celestial writing in the constellations. In fact, my intention in this briefing, as far as the technical aspects go, is to bring you up current with three specific planetary phenomena that reflect closely upon the last stage of reset before correction begins. So there is vital and concrete intel coming in the latter part of this briefing, so don't be put off by the way that I'm taking off here at the outset. But let's return to this issue of who is your enemy. Well, again, use the modified syntax. Who is your self-declared enemy? You see how that changes the picture and really sharpens focus? A while back, going back a few years actually, before the G&E began, I did quite a long series of interviews on Skype with a certain individual. I never met this person in person, but we talked on Skype. We talked and we emailed, but we didn't talk in email very, very much about personal matters. Mostly, we just talked during the interviews. At a certain moment, this individual decided to terminate the interviews and wrote me a very polite and respectful letter saying that he had other pressing concerns in his personal life. He did not declare in his final email to me that he was going to be my enemy with the intention to attack me or to do harm to me in any way, publicly or in any other fashion. Later, it came to my attention that this individual was involved with a small group of people who were attacking me and purporting to expose the evil side of my character or something, or the dangerous and misleading aspects of planetary tantra or whatever. I don't pay any attention to what these people actually did, but I heard from a third party that they were attacking me, that he was part of this small group, which could be defined, I think, accurately as a hate group. They set up at least two platforms on the internet purely and exclusively dedicated to a hate campaign against me. Okay, well, so what? First, in the first place, I did not waste 5 seconds of my time to investigate what these people were doing, nor to refute them in any way. Secondly, I wouldn't consider them to this day to be my enemies. Why not? Because, remember the criterion that I just proposed. Not one of these individuals has written me by an email or talked to me on Skype declaring to me that they are now my enemy. And unless someone does this, how do I know if they're my enemy? So I have to take them on their word, right? I am going into some detail to describe this personal situation with the intention of advising you out there to do the same as me. Try it out and see what results you get. Don't do the same as me because I am some idol that you respect more than anyone else in the world and whom you would not question and blah, blah, blah. But do the same as me, as an exercise, the same exercise as me, to see what results it produces. Now, back to the main point. According to this criterion, I do not consider anyone my enemy who has not declared themselves to be so to me. Now, there's another case that could occur. Some individual who knows me personally or not could go out publicly and declare themselves to be my enemy, and then state publicly what they intend to do to harm me and why they intend to do it. And that would be fine too. In fact, that would be a lot more honest than just undertaking some kind of campaign against me. That would at least be honest. It's easy to slander someone. It's easy to accuse them of things for which there is no evidence. It's easy to fabricate and fabulate around a person. This happens all the time. But the people who do that rarely come out and nakedly, honestly state their intentions. And that would be refreshing, and I would welcome that. And certainly, if I heard from any party whatsoever that someone was coming out publicly, that is to say on the internet, where else could it be, or in writing, saying that they are a self-declared enemy of mine, I would take a look at it. So you see how this particular way of breaking down the issue of enemies and personal conflicts really helps, I would wish it does, to focalize and clarify this issue. I will be addressing this issue from time to time as we proceed, not simply to drag you into something that is happening to me, because things very rarely happen to me, but to illustrate lessons that need to be learned now about the ethics and interactions of members of the Calico War Party before I can say those wonderful words that they use in military jargon, before I can say to the Calico War Party, and such a joy it will be on the day I say it, what the Marines say and what the mercenaries and predators say when they're ready to undertake some murderous and deceitful operation. We're good to go. Well, we're not good to go yet in the Calico War Party, but that's okay, because the Calico War Party is still in formation. I ask you to recall something briefly, to go back and review something with me. From the start of the GNE, I proposed a firewall, remember that? And I said that those of you who come into the GNE on the initial premises would not be required to approve of or even consider the tactics of the lethal strike, contra-violence, and any other controversial issues relating to the Calico War movement. But you know, I start out doing things. I don't know what I'm doing at the beginning. I learn as I go along. I make mistakes. I make adjustments. And you who have followed this GNE from the beginning know exactly what I've done. I've been completely transparent about it. I've corrected and adjusted my stance on this issue. And at a certain point, I said, there's no firewall. And after a certain number of briefings, I can't remember exactly when it was, I began to speak of you in the GNE equally and equivalently as if I were addressing the Calico War Party, which is now in formation. And why have I done that? Be absolutely crystal clear on this. The Calico War Party is nothing more than an expression, a label, for the socially proactive positions to be taken in correction by those who observe the Sophianic narrative and who use Gnostic intel and Gaian tantric intelligence and practices in their lives. That's all it is. It's the name, the general and generic name, for the activist movement that grows out of the GNE. And since we're in the last minute of reset, I am talking more and more simultaneously and equivalently to you as crew members in this experiment and to you as prospective and self-elected Kalika warriors. That is to say, to use the normal term, social activists rooted in the Gaian and Sophianic view of life. Now, it is true that within the 16 ranks of the Kalika War Party, there are ranks, there are wedges, who concern themselves with the execution of the lethal strike against predators. But not all members of the Kalika War Party are in those ranks. So don't be concerned when I use the term that I'm trying to rope you into something you don't want to be in if you don't want to participate in those particular ranks, if you don't want to place yourself in those particular ranks, which is the front line of the war party, then you don't have to. And so what I am saying now, as I say this now, excuse me, as I say this now, I am realizing so intensely that we are at the critical point in this experiment, getting so close to the moment of correction that everything changes now. Everything assumes a new configuration. And what I'm telling you now for the first time in NAV Briefing 103 is something I will repeat again and again in the future. I'll put it in the form of a question. What does it take for us to be good to go, to use military jargon? Well, obviously, the full formation, I call it the Thunderbird formation, you'll see why, of the Kalika War Party needs to be defined with all 16 activist positions need to be defined with a sketch of the target causes of each of those positions and of the methods and intel specific to those positions and specific to those ranks within the overall formation. I intend to deliver that picture by the end of March 2014. Pretty exciting, huh? I have to tell you, I'm really excited about it. And I'm really excited and really cranked with great energy these days. I am so proud and so happy and encouraged by the way this GNE is winding up. I am so proud that I pull myself around to the attitude and capacity and grounding and sobriety and lucidity and direction whereby I can carry it to its conclusion in a noble and magnificent way. I am really, really proud. And the messages that I've been receiving from you over the last couple of weeks have been better than ever. The support I'm getting, more courageous and more lucid than ever. So I'm really happy right now at the way things are going with the GNE, with my shamanic challenges, and with everything in my personal and social life. It's just going blazes. I couldn't be happier. Now, to return to my concluding remarks about this question of enemies and personal conflict, let me emphasize once again that I'm introducing this issue and I will continue to develop it because it is imperatively relevant to the integrity of the ranks of the Kalika War Party. We have to define the warrior ethics within the party in addition to defining the warrior ethics of contra-violence and the battle against the predators. Do you see that connection? I'm seeing that connection for the first time in the last week or so, and it is, I'm thrilled to be seeing this. It is a tremendous breakthrough. My insights about this matter of the intra-party ethics relating to the tactics and strategies that the war party can deploy outwardly is totally sensational. And I cannot tell you how confident I feel about being able to teach and transmit this lesson as I myself am in the process of learning it. Now, last thing I want to say about the subject of enemies right now brings me way, way back to the time when I was about, I guess, 20 years old, and I cast my own horoscope for the first time. You know, I began my career as a professional astrologer, I think around 1965 or 1966, the year that LSD was banned and made illegal, I believe. And then I practiced that for a good 30 years. But of course, the responsibility of every astrologer is to master his or her chart first. That's the great test. I must say I was very disturbed, extremely disturbed and upset when I saw my own horoscope for the first time. And I continued to be upset about it for quite a number of years. One of the factors of my horoscope is that all the planets except one are below the horizon. That means that I'm kind of a Silvio Manuel type, if you'll allow the illusion. And that's to say I work in the background because I don't need to be prominent. I don't need to be a prominent teacher, lecturer, you know, giving seminars, giving conferences, you know. I work from the background and I work from the deep, deep background. And I stay in the background. I don't need to be a celebrity. The power of the Sophianic vision story does not rely or ride upon my celebrity. So, that I can make sense of now. Years ago, you know, it took me a long time to understand and accept what it means to have all planets except one below the horizon. Of course, in a configuration like that, it becomes extremely interesting to the astrologer to assess the meaning of the one planet that is above the horizon. Have I piqued your curiosity? Were you wondering about that? When I was born at 6:01 in the evening in New York City, if you could have seen the sky perfectly, you would have seen the twins rising in the eastern horizon. The feet of the twins would have been coming up above the eastern horizon as the twins rise feet first. And elevated at an angle of maybe 20 degrees above the horizon to the east would have been positioned Uranus. Now, there are some tribes in Africa and in Australia, I believe, some tribal peoples who can actually see Uranus with the naked eye. Generally speaking, human animals today cannot see any celestial object or star or planet below magnitude 6. But it is true, as far as I know, that some people could see Uranus. In any case, Uranus was there, and Uranus in my chart is placed, uniquely positioned, above the horizon. And in the constellations, this would not be observable, actually, but you can visualize it. In the constellations, Uranus stood at that moment just beyond the forehead of the bull, between the horns of the bull. And in regard to the so-called house positions of the horoscope, which I renamed as facets, there are 12 houses or 12 facets. In regard to that position, Uranus is placed in the 12th house. Now, when I saw this, when I was 20 years old, I was, needless to say, rather disturbed, perplexed. And I didn't know how to make jack squat of it for a long time. So I read the books that existed at that time in the mid-60s. And before I totally reinvented astrology in another syntax, I had to rely on the received material, which was not very good. But even today, if you go to a standard astrology book and you read about the 12th house, you will find that every single astrologer says the same thing. It concerns the matter of secret enemies. Secret enemies. Well, what are secret enemies? Well, I put it to you, my friends, that there are no such things as secret enemies. There are just undeclared enemies. So it's not a big secret. It's just something that has not been disclosed, not been revealed. So it's possible that I could have secret enemies. Now, what would they be? And you too could have secret enemies. That would be an individual who in their own minds regards you as an enemy, although they haven't declared it to you openly, and who goes about seeking to hurt you or harm you or your way of life. That would be a secret enemy. Well, you have to say, we're all subject to have secret enemies, right? You know, there's nothing you can do about secret enemies because they could ruin your life or have you killed or kill you themselves and you would never know who they are, right? As a matter of fact, I guess you'd have to, you may be inclined, I'm not going to suggest what you think, you may be inclined, as I do, to regard the situation in the world today, the situation, you know, you might think I'm drunk, but I'm actually just having a nice coffee here, which Nikki is looking down at with great suspicion, because she's thinking of licking the foam. Nikita, you are a ferocious predator. Yes. How could I be concerned about secret enemies when you're sitting there at my desk sucking your tail? No, yes, oh yes, Nikita, shall I declare to the world what the goddess already knows? That is that I have, in addition to your protection, my precious black cat, I have the protection that comes with planetary tantra and the terma of Gaia awakening. For goddess knows the terma does come with its built-in protection. And that's good news indeed, because protection of some kind for the Turton and the Terma against hidden and secret enemies, you know, is a great boon. Protection for the Terma and the Turton, which can be identified in node 17 of the Shakti cluster, is something of high desirability. I know that. And I know that you out there who love and support me add to that supernatural protection by the force of your human and animal love and by the courage and encouragement that you send to me every single day. One moment at a time. And I assure you, don't be alarmed. I am not bringing up the subject because I am in any danger. At least not any more or less than any shaman on this planet. Am I the target of attacks, or what they call in Central and South America, the golpe? You know, the strike, the hit? Am I possibly the target of attacks from other shamans? Well, of course I am. Comes with the territory. But fear not, be not concerned, because there is nothing in the works right now that would warrant undue concern regarding my safety in that respect. I want to emphasize that and reemphasize that point to you so that these comments I've made in the first 35 minutes of this briefing do not leave you with any trace of fear. Fear not. I do not want to infer any fear into your minds. I live fearlessly, whether I'm under attack or not. Okay? So I'll leave the topic there for the moment. Put it on the back burner. Let it cook. Double trouble, boil and bubble. Let it all cook on the back burner. And a little further along, we will revisit that subject. Agreed? So, how do I get around, finally, how do I bring this briefing around to the title of the briefing, Pristine and Copacetic? Well, I propose to do so by actually walking you through the current intel regarding planetary and systemic parameters of navigation. Now, when I use the word planetary, you know what I mean. I refer to the planet Earth. Lunar refers to the sun. Solar refers to the moon. When I use the word systemic, I'm referring to the conditions of the solar system as a whole. And so I'm going to give you now some systemic intel. That is to say, I'm going to talk about other planets apart from the mother planet, namely Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. These are the three planets that stand beyond the orbit of the Earth. And I will attempt to explain the intimate relevance of those planets right now to the last second of reset. What those three planets are doing in the last second of reset is extremely significant. And in addition to that, by introducing these three planets, I should say by giving more attention to them than I've done so far, I am also preparing the way for a consideration of what happens in correction after the reset is completed on the 19th of March 2014. In other words, if you and I together put our heads together over the navigational charts here and look at the specifications of the systemic activity of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn against the constellations, then we are already preparing ourselves to see some of the events due to emerge when correction actually kicks in. How exciting is that? Now, up until this moment, and recently, since the fall, I've concentrated a lot on the planet Venus, known mythologically as Xochiquetzal in the Maya Aztec language. Don't know, it's an Aztec word. And taking the name of Xibalanque when she becomes Black Jaguar and descends into the underworld. The descent of Venus into the underworld corresponds, which is a mythological event for you to imagine, corresponds astronomically to the inferior conjunction of Venus with the Sun. Venus is on an orbital track just inside the Earth. She's moving faster than the Earth, so she periodically overtakes the Earth and passes between the Sun and the Earth, which is exactly where she is as I am speaking at this moment. Now I ask you to give close attention to these details. The Kali shift kicked off the year 2014 on the second day of the year. The preceding Kurukula shift ended on the first day of the year. Fantastic timing. The day of January 9th was the eighth day of the Kali shift. It's and it corresponds to the moment of the first quarter or the quarter moon. Generally, the quarter moon appears, depending on variations, on the seventh or eighth day of a shift. As I've noted, things come into definition regarding Dakini instruction and the themes and motifs and lessons of a shift define themselves vividly at the first quarter. I was stunned, staggered, and thrilled by the definition that I have got in these days, that is to say, the 8th and 9th of January. There's so much lucidity in this Kalika transmission from Kali herself that I have just been floored. I can barely sleep. It's hard for me to go to sleep. I don't know if I can sleep for a while. And sleep is really, really important to me because I'm rather a marmot and I can sleep for 16 hours at a time. I have to tell you, the blazing clarity of this Kalika instruction from the Invincible One herself has been really, really astonishing. Now, bear close attention, because I know that many of you are also attuned to the rhythms and modulations and frequencies of the Dakini shifts. Have you been feeling, as well as me, a kind of, it's an elation. There's an elation that comes with Kali's teaching. She's the great liberator. But that elation is not manic. It's an elation of the warrior. It's the elation of what was called among the warriors of ancient times, furor, F-U-R-O-R. Furor is a word found in medieval records describing certain warrior tribes of Northern Europe, that they would go into battle in a state of furor. Woden ist Furor is a very famous quotation from Adam of Bremen, who wrote about these tribes during the late Middle Ages. Furor could be interpreted as rage, of course, fury, rage. And it is also, I am convinced, an aspect of the healthy sense of morbido. When you, as a male or female human animal, feel the morbido instinct, you feel it as an elation and a furious excitement. And it's that excitement that carries you as a warrior into the battle, into the fray. So I am feeling a tremendous upsurge of this elation, this warrior elation, and lucidity regarding the tactics of the Kalika War Party. This comes about, this upsurgence, which I suspect you may also be feeling, comes about at the exact moment that Venus passes before the Sun, which is the 11th of January. This is an absolutely key moment in the future of the Kalika War Enterprise. And also, I would point out that although the Sun reached what was anticipated to be a peak of sunspot cycles as we entered the GNE, the Sun, as you know, has been inexplicably calm for a couple of years now. During the first week of Kali shift in 2014, the Sun started to act up ferociously. The Sun began to demonstrate furor. She, the mother star, Sabaoth, who is allied to Sophia in her planetary form, flared up in a coronal mass ejection that has pretty much surpassed any previous event of that kind. A coronal mass emission of an extremely high magnitude transpired just at the moment that Venus passed between the Earth and the Sun. That would be the moment January 11th, when Ishbalanque reached her deepest immersion in Xibalba, in the underworld. So much for the astronomical intel regarding Venus that is relevant to this moment. Well, Venus is, as I said, inside the orbit of the Earth. What about the three planets outside the orbit of the Earth? Well, we'll take them from the furthermost and come in. The first one, then, is Saturn. You may recall that I mentioned recently that Saturn remains close to the fulcrum of the scales during most of 2014. And it gets even better than that. Not only is Saturn near the fulcrum of the scales and aligned to the vertical beam, the upright beam that forms the supporting structure of the scales, but it actually makes a loop around that upright beam. Well, how do you like them potatoes, me mateys? Currently, at this exact moment, Saturn is on that vertical beam. 2021 degrees of Scorpio is the mark on the ecliptic scale, which is the scale of the 12 astrological signs, which indicates that place in the visible constellations where the vertical beam or support of the scales can be observed. It's as simple as that. Saturn is there right now, and you can observe it if you'd like. Now, according to its routine orbital motion, Saturn is moving toward the Scorpion, from the scales into the Scorpion. And as you view it from the northern hemisphere, that is from right to left against the background of the constellations. But if you observe over the next month and a half, you'll see that it moves very, very slowly, and actually at a certain moment it comes to a stop, which is the stationary retrograde moment. The retrograde station in astronomical lingo is the moment when an orbiting planet actually stops, like a vehicle that stops before it reverses. That would be March 4th, and Saturn then would be placed in 24 degrees of Scorpio, which is about 3 degrees off the exact alignment to that vertical beam, and that is about 6 times the diameter of the full moon. On that moment, March 2nd, Saturn begins its 5-month-long retrograde cycle. It turns direct, again, this is called stationary direct, on the 21st of July in 17 degrees of Scorpio. If you stand back and look at the entire picture here, it's perfectly and symmetrically balanced. Saturn stands right now in the Kali shift, in the beginning of 2014, in perfect alignment with the vertical axis of the scales. Then it moves 3 degrees to the left, and then it makes a loop and moves back 3 degrees off that axis to the right. And then it turns direct, as I said, on the 21st of July, and it makes its final transit in exact alignment to the fulcrum or axis, vertical axis, around the fall equinox in September of 2014. Now, in this pattern of systemic movements, which is observable, by systemic I mean concerning planets in the solar system, irrespective of the planet Earth itself, in this pattern, what do we see? Well, the navigator and star diviner decodes it in this way. The human species has now arrived at the moment of critical balance in its affairs that will determine the outcome of civilization and the outcome of the remainder of this experiment till the end of the Kalpa in 2216. And among the many events and many developments that we can anticipate in the scope of this reset, in the scope of this adjustment, holding the possibility of getting humanity back on track, the central and key development highlighted by Saturn at the fulcrum of the scales is equality between men and women, holding them to the same standard, not favoring either the ethics and sensibilities of one gender over the other, and coming to a consensus about common law and about the definition of Gaian ethics. Now, I've said that it is my intention as a teacher of planetary tantra and a transmitter of the Sophianic vision story to define Gaian ethics, to lay the foundation for Gaian ethics. You can see how I operate. It's as clear as day. And I've been doing this for 40 years, but I have not publicly disclosed how I do it, nor have I invited students and allies and friends like you to participate in doing it with me in real time. I don't make a move without coordinating myself with the cosmic code beyond astrology and the celestial writing that every genuine shaman observes as a diviner of the sky. And I assure you that if you coordinate your life and your concerns and your activities and your lessons and your initiatives, personal and transpersonal, with the timing indicated by the writing in the sky, then your actions take on a magnitude and power that they could not otherwise have. And just imagine if there are 10, 20, 30, 3,000, 30,000 human animals on the planet simultaneously doing the same thing, simultaneously observing the same signal. Just imagine what might happen were that to be the case. It is my highest desire that that is the case. And I happily dedicate the rest of my life to providing the direction and syntax so that we can at least try that. We can at least try it. I'm not making you any promises. But so that we can at least try to coordinate ourselves in the vision of Gaia Sophia, according to those directives, those visionary and acoustic signals provided to the human species from the cosmos itself and from the realm of the pleromic aeons. Okay, so much for Saturn. Now, what about Jupiter? Well, remember, recall the date I just mentioned. Saturn begins its retrograde cycle, which lasts 5 months, on the 4th of March, 2014, just a few days before the completion of reset. Well, Jupiter began its retrograde cycle, which is now in progress, back in November, just around the 8th of November, interestingly. The first week in November. Ah, I remember that week very well. And at that time, it was in 21 degrees of Cancer, which is on the template of the ecliptic. That is to say, 111 degrees of ecliptic latitude, which places it visually and graphically at the head of the twins. So it began to reverse then, moving from left to right, as we observe in the Northern Hemisphere. And I can show, and I would like to show in a future briefing, how it actually makes a kind of loop again. Strange. It makes a loop around the waist of the two twins, as if it were using a thread, as if we were winding a thread around the waist of the two twins, around their torsos, in order to bind them together. My, oh my, what is that graphical revelation all about? Does it make you think of something? Does it perhaps make you think of a ceremony that I described? A telestic seance that happened here at Embergain House? Do you maybe recall that I said that certain Colombian allies belonging to a genial species of psychoactive mushroom requested that I and my apprentice draw two mycelium threads from the organic light, put them together, wind them together into a single thread, and hand over that dual-stranded thread to those allies to be given to Shibalanki as she descends into the underworld, Black Jaguar, with the thread of dreaming together in her teeth. Now, if that thread is indeed dreaming together, could the gesture, the graphic action of Jupiter making a circle around the waist of the twins represent the moment upon this planet for the revelation of the method of dreaming together, which is the supreme tantric and shamanic method of the future? And that is such. Could it all be so? Well, we'll see, my friends. Hang in there, stay on board. Jupiter remains in its retrograde cycle until, get this, I mean, get the granular detail here, folks. Just let me interject. I have said before, and I have to say it again because it gives me enormous pleasure. Why does it give me enormous pleasure? Because I have been a dedicated astrologer and sky diviner my entire life. I'm going to be so arrogant as to say that there's nobody on this planet that can read the sky the way I can, nor can anyone read a horoscope the way I can. And one of the great lessons that I learned from my experience, I pass on to you, is precisely this. The beauteous pattern of the cosmos as it interfaces with the human psyche is revealed in the granular detail of the sky and not in any large abstract patterns or planetary aspects as astrologers widely claim. Care for a dose of granular detail? Well, how about this? Saturn turns stationary retrograde on the 4th of March. But on the 7th of March, 3 days away, Jupiter turns direct. How do you make that? At the very moment that Saturn stops, ready to reverse, Jupiter stops, ready to move ahead. They're both stopped at the same moment in the first week of March. This is a remarkable granular detail in the systemic operations of the solar system. I could blow another half hour describing simultaneous granular detail events in the solar system that are current and extend through the next 2 months. I'm not going to do that right now because I'm at the end of this briefing, but I will, if I remember, pick up those details and elaborate them to you as appropriate in future briefings. Just right now, right here at this one point, I would like to interject a brief statement to my students and particularly to the crew of the GNE. I don't know what you think I expect of you, or if you have ever thought that I demand something of you. You know, as a teacher, I don't know if I'm a good teacher. I love to teach. And teaching is a Jupiterian occupation, by the way. And in some respects, I may be, pretty good at it, or I may be lousy in other respects. No one is absolutely perfect and infallible in anything. But I have to say that I think as a teacher, I'm not really too demanding of my students. I'm pretty loose and easy. But I do make one demand now, and I make it on the basis of the experiences I've had through the GNE, and in particular, on the basis of recent experiences with certain dedicated students, or those who declared themselves to be so. I know that some of you who follow these briefings have difficulty with the astronomical aspects. I knew a long, long time ago, when I started to teach astrology in Santa Fe, combining it with astronomy, that some people cannot digest this material. I've seen students get a glazed look in their eye, in their eyes, and come close to falling into a coma if I start to talk about any kind of astrological and astronomical intel, particularly astronomical. But now the time has come to say that there is a requirement for staying with me in the future after the GNE briefings are over. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do by way of briefings or talks or teachings after March 2014. But those of you who would be inclined to follow my expositions and to continue at moments to receive briefings with astronomical content must get on with the language and the science. Because if you do not get on with the astronomy, and I will record lessons to help you. I will do an astronomy class with you and for you. I will talk with someone on Skype who loves the GNE and the Sophianic Vision and wants to follow the astronomy but has problems. And I'll talk with that crew member on Skype and record the conversation and make it available to you. I'll do whatever it takes, but I require that you get a handle on the astronomical material, or else you will be blown out of the rigging. I've seen people blown out of the rigging. The rigging is the astronomical structure of the visionary and imaginative code operating in the Sophianic message as it reaches the human endopsyche today and emerges from the human endopsyche. So, I will do whatever I can within my goddess-given capacities as a teacher to teach you a certain degree of mastery and confidence with the astronomical terms and the material. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be in correction and live in the Sophianic narrative and benefit from the Gnostic intel. If you don't do this, you certainly can. But you can't be in intimate collaboration with me if you don't do this. My use of the astronomical material in both a scientific and a visionary way is a unique mark of my method as a teacher and, if you will, a Latter-day Telestis. Now, this method that I employ with the astronomical content may be compared to what has been called the Maieutic method. M-A-I-E-U-T-I-C. Go look it up. Maieutic. And there is even a branch of knowledge known as Maieutics. Quite simply, the Maieutic method refers to a Greek term which refers to a midwife. It literally means midwifing. So when I present the astronomical material, I am midwifing in an educational and pedagogical way your capacity to grasp the cosmic syntax of your own imagination. And I probably am somewhat accomplished in using this method. Could you give me that? And I would like to be and love to be accomplished in conferring and transmitting it as well. That would be an enormous satisfaction to me. Anyone and everyone who loves the Earth and the planetary vision of Gnosticism that I've recovered can follow Sophia's correction and be in it in whatever way they like. But you can only be in it with me as intimate collaborators and students if you learn the astronomical factors and how to follow them and use them and speak them. That's what I mean by staying in the rigging. I recently saw some people who claim to be and would have loved to be close and intimate collaborators with me in realizing and actualizing the Sophianic vision. People that I know personally, have met in person, but they cannot be so because they showed neither the desire nor the capacity to learn the astronomical material. So they were blown out of the rigging. It's funny, you know, sometimes I picture myself as a Zen master. Man, that's the joke of the ages. And this is how I operate as a Zen master. I've got an ice cream cone in my hand, and it's a pretty hot day, so the ice cream cone is melting fast. When there's two or three students around me, two or three, you know, neophytes, Zen practitioners, pretenders to Zen, pretenders to Satori, and they're around me, and it's like I'm presenting them with my ice cream cone, it's melting in my hand. What is my ice cream cone? Well, it's like a fountain of koans. it's a fountain of Zen riddles by which I am testing their state of self-realization. And this goes on and on until the ice cream cone melts, which is quite rapidly. But in the process of that whole comedy, you know, you can speak of a comedy of enlightenment. In the course of that old comedy, no one asked me how my ice cream tastes. Alas and alack, huh? Alas and alack. So it goes with the fickleness of human animals. You know, even in face of the sublime mysteries of the cosmos, they go off the handle in a fickle moment of offense. So while you're contemplating that little story about the Zen master and his ice cream cone, you might also savor this citation from The Fire from Within. Quote, "That's the stalker's method," Don Juan said. "It fosters not understanding, but total realization," end quote. You know, as I read those words, I get a funny sensation up my spine. It's a sensation I get, and it spreads across my skin. I have soft skin. And it happens that way when I get a certain rush. The rush comes when I have the impression that I'm going to say something that's never been said before. When I'm going to put into language something that's never been expressed before. And here it is. The common factor in Zen and stalking is that they both do not seek to deliver understanding, but total realization. I don't know. Have you ever considered the similarity between Zen masters and Castaneda stalkers? Well, I never did until just this moment. Easy come, easy go, huh? Now, I'm going to put the Jupiter intel aside, but I will return to the matter of being blown out of the rigging to give a much more extensive account of what Jupiter is doing in right now in the month of January and what it is doing in its extraordinary retrograde cycle that appears in the sky as a gesture of encircling the waist of the twins. Schedule that for a future briefing. Right now, in the remaining few minutes, just let me get to Mars. I'd love to get to Mars. I don't want to get to Mars on a spaceship. I want to get to Mars in the myutic astronomical jargon of the GNE. You want to come along? Okay. Here we go. Here's the dreaded astronomical intel. Let's see if you can follow it. Right now, as I speak, Mars is located in around 15 degrees of the sign Libra on the ecliptic scale. In the real sky constellations, that places it in the middle of the torso of the Virgin, and it can actually be observed in that position. A point of systemic structure that corresponds to Mars' position but cannot be observed is the aphelion of Jupiter. That is, Mars now stands in the sky at the point where, when Jupiter stands at the same point, it is most distant from the Sun. So, the aphelion of Jupiter is around 15 degrees of Libra. The opposite point, the perihelion of Jupiter, is around 15 degrees of Aries. And considered together, these two opposite points are called the apsides. A-P-S-I-D-E-S. The apsides of Jupiter. Does that ring a bell? Does that term remind you of something? I seem to recall at the beginning of this experiment saying that the correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. Well, that's exactly where Mars is as I'm speaking to you right now. And I can assure you that even though I make these recordings in real time and they may go out a little bit later, that anyone listening to my words a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, or 10 years from now, who gets what I'm saying, must know that this intel can never be dated. Because even though you might not have been there in real time when I made this observation, you in the future can register the observation. And you can register the importance it had to us, my friends and allies, my students, in this moment in the GNE, and what a momentous experience it was. And you can join in that experience in your time and your place. And I speak to you now in the future as if I am there already with you. And who knows? Maybe I already am in the future. Remember that Kali destroys the illusion of linear time, doesn't she? So how does Mars behave from this moment on? Well, can you see what's coming? Actually, Mars also executes a retrograde cycle. It proceeds through the Virgin, and it doesn't get very far from where it is right now. It actually gets to about 27 degrees of Libra. And there, well, gee whiz and gee willikers, Mrs. Calabash. On March 3rd, it turns retrograde in 28 degrees of Libra, just beyond the star Spica, marking the sheaf of wheat in the hand of the Virgin. March 3rd, Mars turns retrograde on March 3rd, Jupiter turns direct on March 7th, and Saturn turns retrograde on March 4th. Oopsie-daisy! All three of the outer planets are stationary, neither moving, forward or backward, at exactly the same moment within a period of 3 or 4 days at the beginning of March. I defy any astronomer who has access to the software that can calculate such matters to find another moment when that occurred. I'm talking granular detail. You can observe. Are you interested? Go out and look at it while it's happening. And not only can you look at it and observe it, my friends, and engage your first attention, but you can engage your second attention and your imagination in the dimension of what it displays. And what does it display? It displays the power and beauty and magic that is emerging from your own mind, which is so immense in scope that you need the feedback device of the whole sky-filled panorama of constellations to show you what you have in yourself as the divine endowment of that luminous child, who is the magical child of the aeons of fire. That animal walking this planet, filled with that sublime inspiration of magical talent, is what you are. It is the only thing you can be, and you cannot become anything but more beautiful in the realization of that endowment. Until now, we haven't considered closely the role that Mars would play in the realization of the divine endowment of the Anthropos. But that moment has come. I am here doing the usual stuff and getting it out to you as it comes to me. And so, I come to the end of this briefing, and I have not yet got to the title of pristine and copacetic, have I? Well, you see, it tells you something about how I'm operating here, that I can't predict or control this material, and I wouldn't want to. Yeah, I gotta have my fun too, you know. So I'm just going to designate that this is part one of NAV Briefing 103, or part one of this topic. That's better. And I'll make NAV Briefing 104, pristine and copacetic, part two. And then I will define these terms, which are fantastic terms that I am totally thrilled about. Terms and tools of an extraordinary kind for the Calico War Party. And in defining those words, I will elaborate on the role of Mars in current and future events. And for right now, for right this moment, giving you an anticipatory focus on what's coming, I would just state something that I know from my astrological practice with thousands of clients over 3 decades of my life. That is that Mars stands for self-assertion. And so, lessons about self-assertion now come into view in the last second of the reset and will continue to be a source of enlightenment and ethical responsibility in correction itself. So focus on that concept, self-assertion. What is the correct and salubrious form of self-assertion proper to those who engage in Sophia's correction? With that question, I conclude this briefing and invite you to its sequel, Nav Briefing 104, which I am calling by the same title and indicating as part 2.